You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
So we have been confronted all the way through the book of Galatians with two different groups of people. Really, one person versus a whole group of people. On the one hand, you have Paul, and Paul is angry, he's deeply concerned, and he's used language like he used last week, which I waited personally. I knew this was coming weeks to get to. He actually tells the Galatians that he hopes that the false teachers would just go all the way and emasculate themselves, was the word I think the ESV translated it as. Castrate might be a great word, but I love the idea. So that's what we were waiting for all week. Paul saying, hey, this is a big deal. I'm really angry at these guys, and it's such a big deal. I wish they would just go all the way with the whole thing. On the other hand, you have the false teachers who've arrived in Galatia, and the false teachers are telling the church in Galatia, hey, Paul came, he told you about Jesus, he told you you should believe in Jesus, he told you by believing in Jesus, you receive all the promises of God, and he got it mostly right, but we just want to add some things to it, kind of help you make your way better in the world as Christians, as the children of Abraham. And the way that you're going to do that is you're going to come under the law. If you will obey the law supremely through circumcision, but that means symbolic of all of the law. If you'll come under the law and obey the law, then and only then, by coming under the law, will you be accepted as the children of God. And Paul looks at that and says, let's go back to chapter 1. Let them be accursed. Everything is at stake in this argument between Paul saying, look, you cannot add anything to the gospel. The gospel is you are justified, you are freely accepted, you are brought into the family of God, not on the basis of anything that you do, but solely on the basis of you trusting on, relying upon, receiving the work of Jesus on your behalf. And last week, we came to kind of this turn in the book of Galatians as Paul begins to address a very valid pastoral concern that's been raised by these false teachers. These false teachers who are coming to the church in Galatia, they see a problem. And the problem is this. If you have a room full of people who all want to go do crazy things, who don't want to live under with any sort of moral norms. In fact, they've come from a culture that worshipped idols, that practiced all kinds of sexual deviance, that was corrupt down to its core. They've come out of that culture and now are trying to figure out what does it mean to follow God? What does it mean to know God and love God? That these teachers who come into Galatia are addressing a very, very real concern. How do you get them to act differently? How do you get them to stop living like Gentiles? How do you get them to stop living like kind of the whole Roman community in Galatia that's worshiping idols, that's kind of living however they want to live without any of the norms from the scriptures? Now, their answer to that was to hold out to them a threat. Look, if you really want to be loved by God, if you really want to be accepted by God, if you really want to make it into the family of Abraham and really receive all the promises of God, then you have to live differently. And if you'll live differently, then you'll inherit all of these promises. And Paul's answer to that last week that he's going to expand upon this week is that goes back to an age that frankly, the law could not do what they're saying the law is trying to do. Let me explain it this way. But Paul has held out to us that there's a fundamental problem with humanity. He described it as we live under the elementary principles of the world, that we live by the flesh. Flesh is going to be an important word in the chapter today. What he means by that is that we all tend to live in the world by our own strength, seeking salvation by our own strength. Now, salvation doesn't have to be a religious term. Everyone in the world is seeking salvation. Now, they define it really differently. So some may say, some like these Judaizers might come and say, salvation is acceptance before God. Others would say salvation is achieving kind of maximal leisure and pleasure. Others would say salvation is kind of a high level of professional success or financial freedom or a great marriage and kids and kind of the idyllic family. Whatever your definition of salvation is, what Paul says is that prior to the coming of Jesus, the tendency in the world, the tendency for this church in Galatia and for Jews, however you define salvation is to do it under the elementary principles of the world or to do it by the flesh, which meant you try to achieve those things and seek those things by your own strength, by something internal to yourself. We talked about it a few weeks ago as this constant impulse to try to bring something of yourself to God and say, look, I'm worthy, I'm acceptable. This impulse to bring something before God, to say, look, I'm worthy of something other than death. I'm worthy of life. I'm worthy to achieve happiness and pleasure and delight, whatever that thing may be. And Paul says, look, these false teachers are coming to you and they're saying, look, they're saying to you in the end, the way that you achieve salvation, the way that you achieve acceptance before God, the way that you receive all the promises of God for salvation is you obey the law. And he says, the law simply can't overcome the flesh. It simply can't beat that fundamental impulse in us. And so in the end, it will never get you salvation. It will never get you acceptance before God. It will never get you eternal leisure and pleasure and happiness. It will never ultimately give you the thing that you're seeking there. It's powerless to do it because it leaves you fundamentally unchanged. An illustration I've heard used, I think I've used it here before, it is, we had an apple tree at our old house when we lived up on Federal. We had this apple tree, and it was a small, weak apple tree. And it produced devastatingly bad, hard apples. Like, you could kill someone with these apples. Like, if they tried to bite it, it would break their jaw. If you threw it at their head, it was like a rock being thrown at your head. It was really bad. I mean, I don't know that you should throw apples at people's heads in general, but these apples especially. And so they were green and gnarly and bad. They only produced bad fruit. And Paul says, look, obeying the law, thinking that I have to somehow change myself by producing these good works is like me going out to that apple tree and you know what? It's not producing good apples. It's not producing good fruit. Something wrong in its core. I've got these Honeycrisp apples, which I know they're not like Honeycrisp aren't like real apples. They're like apples invested with goodness in a way that's like amazing. And me stapling those apples to this tiny apple tree that probably would have collapsed under the weight and saying, look, here is life. And Paul says that is what life kind of by the flesh or under the elementary principles of the world or trying to earn salvation or kind of by your own self-effort, prove that you're good enough to God. It's kind of like stapling Honeycrisp apples on the really bad apple tree that we owned at our old house. You've left the tree unchanged. In other words, it's a facade. You might be able to pull the apple down and it tastes better than the apples that normally come out of that tree, but the tree is not actually producing anything good, anything wholesome, anything. It's not actually been transformed down to its core. And he said, that's what the law does. That's what your attempts at self-salvation and good behavior before God ultimately try to do. And we saw last week that that's not what God is up to. He's not just trying to staple good fruit on you. He's not simply trying to get you to behave better. The God of the universe is not expending his infinite energy in the hopes that you'll learn better habits. He's up to something way, way bigger. And that's what we're going to look at today in this text. And so let's look at just a couple of things as we ask the question, how does this kind of change, this kind of transformation that we think Paul's actually aiming at, this transformation that's not merely surface, not just kind of a behavioral change, but actually a transformation of who we are, let's actually see how this takes place. And to do so, I want to point out three things in the text, and then we'll be done. It sounds very simple before I do it, but it won't be simple. All right, so look with me first. He ended the section last week that we looked at by saying that neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything but only faith working through love. And then he contrasts a set of works that the flesh do, that living by the flesh produces, and a set of fruit that is produced by the Spirit of God. And I want to make this observation to you as we think about these two lists. They're both utterly and foundationally relational. And now, for those of us in this room who are introverts, the point I'm about to make is troubling. That's why I make it first, because I don't like this point, so I'm going to get it out of the way. The kind of transformation that God is producing in us is most evident and most clearly seen exclusively in the context of interpersonal relationships with people, but that would be repetitive. Of interpersonal relationships, not interpersonal relationships with other non-people. Like, think about it. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control. Faith working itself out in love. The kind of Christianity, the kind of transformation that God's working in us, it's not merely kind of external and behavioral. It has almost exclusively to do with how you relate to, treat, and connect with other people around you. And I think we've all experienced this, right? I mean, prior to getting married, I thought I was a pretty unselfish dude. I was nice. I shared things. People came over. I would make them a box of mac and cheese with my box of mac and cheese. My wife laughed because when she came to visit me in college, it was horrific how many boxes of mac and cheese were in my cabinet. But like, I felt pretty unselfish. Like, I shared. I was nice. Smiled at people and said hi. Buy a cup of coffee. I was a good, unselfish person. And then you get married. And suddenly you realize you're the most selfish human being that's ever lived on the planet. Like, just where the blankets go on your bed, how many of those stupid pillows go on the bed, where towels end up after you take a shower. Before, they were on the floor, but now all of a sudden I'm married, and throwing them on the floor means someone else is going to pick them up. What you eat for dinner every night. A million questions all are now confronted with the fact that I am really selfish. Now, would have never been evidenced, would have never been seen, would have never like been really apparent to me, except for the fact that now God had thrust me into this relationship, not just with a girlfriend, not just with someone I cared a lot about, but somebody who's actually living in the same house as me, eating the same food as me, sleeping in the same bed as me, and we have to, she's just there every night. Like, we come home, and she's still there. And like, we use the same bathroom, and even like toilet paper. Like, we have massive disagreements early on, like whether you do the flap facing you or the flap underneath, which is obviously over the top. Like, that's the most obvious thing in the world. But those are arguments we have. Thank you. People have tried to explain to me why it goes underneath. My wife is trying to explain to me why it goes underneath. And it's nonsense. It's nonsensical. But you realize you're confronted in those interpersonal relationships how utterly selfish you are. And it would have never been exposed otherwise. I remember prior to us having the twins, and heading into having our children, I thought, now after these few years of marriage, all of the selfish kinks have been worked out. I am almost holy. I am a good, unselfish, kind person. And then you have twins. And then they poop at night and cry about it. And you're laying there, and both of you are awake. But you're trying to pretend like you're asleep. Right? And you kind of like, wait, are they going to get up first? Am I going to get up first? And then you have this incredible thought of like, I am so selfish. Like, I am And I'm running through reasons why I should be justified and not get out of bed because I have to go do this, this, and this tomorrow morning. And she doesn't have to go do this, this, and this in the morning. Therefore, she should get up. So I'm going to pretend like I'm asleep. Like, I feel a little bit shame right now because everyone's just sitting and staring at me like I'm a terrible person. But, like, you're confronted with the fact that you're selfish. Why? Because now all of a sudden, it first was like, now there's another human being living in the house. Now there's like three other human beings living in the same house as me. That everything I do, everything I say, everything I do or don't do affects them. And that kind of selfishness, that kind of, would have never been exposed if I wouldn't have gotten married, if we wouldn't have had children. And so the thing I want us to see right off the bat, number one, is that the kind of fruit that God is trying to produce in us as he transforms us, as he changes us through the gospel, is supremely seen in the way that we relate to other people. Love requires another person. Joy is generally in the context of other people. Patience is absolutely in the context of other people. Kindness, gentleness, self-control. We live in a relational world. There's a book called The Relational Soul by Richard or Robert Plass. It's an R, last name Plass. And he makes the contention in this book, and I actually agree with him, that any real lasting transformation that God wants to work in our life happens in the context of relationships, always. He gives a very kind of theological argument for this and the basis of God's being himself as a Trinity, as the Trinitarian God. But in the end, this is, sorry introverts, like, God wants to change you. He wants to transform you on the inside. He wants to make you not just a rotten fruit tree with fruit kind of stapled on. He actually wants to make you a different kind of tree that relates to people differently. Second thing I want us to see, that the fruits of the Spirit are, and I'm going to use a word that Jonathan Edwards wrote as he was describing the fruits of the Spirit. They're concatenated. Okay, point number three. Just joking. So what does concatenated mean? It's a great word. It means that they are interdependent. They're connected, that they're related. In other words, the way that God has designed us to function, the way that these fruits of the Spirit kind of arise in our life, they don't rise independently of each other. In other words, you don't become a more humble person without also becoming a more patient person. You don't become a more humble person without becoming the kind of person who exercises, clearly more exercises self-control. That all of these things are interrelated. Let me give you just a couple of examples. Let's think about patience and peace. Let's say, just for instance, that like last night, you were getting ready to go have dinner at some people's houses, some friends' houses, and you were supposed to be there at 6 p.m. that we're supposed to be there, 6:30, and it's 6:15, and you realize that no one in your house is ready to go. And that some people are taking a long time to get ready to go, and we've got a weird thing happening where we've decided to sell some things on Craigslist at 6:15, and you've got a whole lot of things happening, and their house, you look up on Google Maps, and their house is 28 minutes away without traffic, and you're about to get into traffic. There is, in that moment, a lack of patience, which expresses itself, at least for me at times, as a lack of peace, like a flappiness, my wife would call it. An anxiety, a frustration, a not peaceful. Whatever it is, it's the opposite of peace. I'm not at rest. I'm not calm. I'm like getting mad at really dumb things, snapping at people that I shouldn't be snapping at. But the two are interrelated. You see that? But like, if I was patient, if I was truly the kind of person that the Spirit had worked patience into. As I'm standing there, I'm patient with my family that's moving slower than they should move. I'm patient with the fact that this family that's coming to end up not buying the piece of furniture. I'm patient with the fact that they're late and they didn't buy the furniture. And if I'm patient, then how does that express itself? It expresses itself with peace. I'm a peaceful presence in the midst of all of that seeming chaos. I might say, oh, hey, child who's not quite dressed yet, you should get dressed peacefully. But they're interconnected, right? A lack of patience expresses itself with a lack of peace. And I would say self-control and joy. What is a lack of self-control? Why do you compulsively eat or compulsively buy things or compulsively or whatever particular compulsivities you practice and pursue in your life with a lack of self-control? Well, oftentimes it's deeply connected to a lack of joy. You're just not satisfied, so you need something else. You need something else to complete. You need something else to make me happy. I need to see this. I need to be able to have the freedom to eat what I want to eat or do what I want to do. It's a lack of self-control grounded in a lack of joy. But when you come to this place of experiencing real joy, it expresses itself in a kind of self-control. We can go on and on. The point being, as Paul puts on display these fruits of the Spirit, they're deeply interconnected. They're not the kind of thing that you can work on one in isolation from another. Oftentimes, those of us in this room, I find it really hard to relate to you, are just hardwired for self-control, right? You are extremely disciplined in what you eat. You're extremely disciplined in how you work out. You're extremely disciplined in what time you get up and what time you go to bed and how many hours per month you're allowed to turn on Netflix. You are a picture of self-control, and you are a complete lack of humility. They're completely interconnected. That God, as he transforms us, he transforms all of us, changing us, not just working on this trait over here and leaving these untouched, but rather as he transforms us and makes us more humble people, that leads us into greater degrees of self-control, which leads us into greater degrees of joy, which makes us more patient, which makes us more peaceful, which in turn makes us more faithful or courageous. They're all deeply interconnected. One of the things that just struck me as I reflected on this passage this week is Paul is a genius as he reflects upon the nature of the human condition. To not be changed from the inside, if we become those who live by the flesh, by kind of our own moral self-effort, or maybe immoral self-effort, but our life is determined by our own strength, our own pursuits, not by resting in and receiving the grace of the gospel, rather kind of either trying to prove ourselves morally or religiously or by throwing achievement or throwing pleasures. He says that, that kind of life produces a set of works, and he describes them in terms of envy, in terms of a set of works that all kind of go together. Look at them again. Sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. These aren't just desire. For Paul, as he explains this to us, they're not just kind of these illicit desires that exist out there. These are things that actually arise from a heart, from a life that's dependent on yourself. Living on your own strength, finding and defining salvation in terms of your own moral self-effort, it leads to envy. It leads to strife. It leads to kind of creating second-class groups of people so you can somehow elevate yourself. It leads to compulsive sexual behaviors. It leads to all kinds of things that Paul says are all rooted in, ultimately, at its heart. Not just that you kind of broke a list of rules, but you believed in the depths of your being that somehow salvation is dependent on me. Luther described this by saying that the most foundational sin in the universe is a failure to believe and to receive the gospel, a failure to believe that God saves us, not I save myself. And honestly, man, the first time I heard that, I thought that was stupid. That's not the foundational sin. There's all kinds of other sins. But I think in this text, Paul's main point is, no, actually that is the foundational sin that gives rise to all other impulses, all other works of the flesh, all other envying and sexual immorality and all the things that he lists here. They don't just come out of nowhere. They're not just like natural desires out there. They actually grow out from and are the works that come from living in such a way that you rely completely on yourself. And vice versa. That living by the Spirit, walking by the Spirit, produces a kind of transformation of who we are that produces this holistic orb of change. It's not patience in isolation. It's not humility in isolation. It's not courage and faithfulness in isolation. It's all of those things together manifesting themselves as we relate to one another. Last point I want to draw your attention to before we end. It's been pointed out by maybe every preacher who's ever preached this text and every commentator who comments on this text that he says that these are the works of the flesh and these are the fruits of the Spirit. Look with me if you don't believe me. If you see this list, patience, humility, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, which that really means this fidelity, this courageous fidelity to God. If you see that list as kind of like, I'm going to go home this week and I'm going to work on patience. I'm going to be a more patient person this week. If you see this list and say, you know what? I'm not very kind. I'm going to work on being kind this week or more gentle or more courageous and faithful. Then you've actually misunderstood and subverted the very thing that Paul's trying to call us to in this text. His point in all of this is to say that, look, these fruits are things that grow out of something else. See, God's concern is not to give us a list through Paul. Hey, the issue is not circumcision. The issue really is kindness. The issue is not kind of sexual morality. The issue is really gentleness. The issue is not obeying the food laws from the Old Testament. No, the real issue is we want you to be more faithful and courageous. He's not saying, hey, the problem with the Judaizers is they said the law was this, and no, really the law is this. And so you need to work not on obeying this stuff, but obeying this stuff. That would be to miss his argument altogether and actually to do the opposite of what he wants you to do. You would just replace circumcision with kindness, which sounds awful. Because can you ever be kind enough? In circumcision, it's at least defined, right? I've been circumcised. I should not have that. Never mind. But have I been kind? No, his point is to say this. No, if you're abiding in the Spirit, if you're walking in the Spirit, if this new life has been born in you, then the evidence of that life will be kindness. It will be gentleness. It will be humility. It will be self-control. So then the fundamental question, how do we grow that stuff? How do we cultivate those things in our lives? And his answer, this very obtuse, difficult answer, is by the Spirit, not by the flesh. Not by gritting your teeth and working really hard at it to prove that you can be a patient person. But by being so transformed by the presence of God in your life, so transformed by dwelling in and trusting by faith in who God is for us by his Spirit, that patience grows out of you. Self-control grows out of you. Kindness grows out from you. Faithfulness and courage grows out from you. And what is this work of the Spirit? Flip over with me to chapter 3. I just want to remind you of something that he's already said. As you're turning there, He mentions that those who walk by the Spirit have crucified the works of the flesh, the flesh itself. So how do we become, another way to think about this is, how do we become the kinds of people that, yes, that these things grow out from? And two, how do we become the kind of people who every single time our flesh, our own moral self-efforts, our own need to prove ourselves, our own need to attain our own salvation rears its head, it gets killed and crucified? How do we become those kinds of people? Starting verse 1 of chapter 3. O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? It was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified. Let me ask you only this. Did you receive the Spirit by works of the law or by, and here's the key, hearing with faith? How do we become the kinds of people that walk by the Spirit? Hearing with faith. It is a beholding, it is a setting our eyes on, our ears on, our minds on, our lives on, beholding the beauty, the glory, the majesty, and supremely, the gospel of Jesus. How do we become the kinds of people who live by the Spirit, who walk in step with the Spirit, who are more patient, more kind, more gentle, more humble, more faithful, more courageous? How do we become those kinds of people? It's not by working to become those kinds of people. It's by setting before you again and again and again and again and believing and receiving by faith again and again and again and again the weight, the glory, the compelling beauty of who Jesus is. When you struggle with patience, set before your mind the promises of God, the sure promises of God that aren't dependent on your timeliness. But when you're afraid, when you are contemplating compromising and not being faithful anymore, set before you, remind yourself of the utter faithfulness of Jesus to keep us, to walk with us, to protect us. But when you're plagued by I'm not loving, I don't like this person, I want to lay down my life for their good, contemplate, rest in, meditate on the infinite love of God for you as a father who sent his son to lay down his life for your sins. But when you lack humility, set before you the infinite glories of a sovereign, holy, glorious God that will absorb and draw to himself all praise, all honor, all worship forever and ever and ever. See, the way you become more humble, the way you become more patient, the way you become more kind is you come back again and again and again to contemplate, to think upon, to sing in response to the glories of all that Jesus is. But by fixing your gaze on him, by contemplating him, by thinking on him, the Spirit begins to transform you and work into you by faith. The kind of change that produces humility, it produces grace, it produces patience, it produces kindness, it produces courage and faithfulness. Our goal when we gather here on Sundays, it is to be reminded as we encounter the Spirit of God, the Spirit promised to us and given to us at Pentecost, to come to this table with bread and wine, to be reminded week after week after week after week of what God is like and what he's done for us in Jesus, and to hear those things, to see those things, to taste those things with faith, believing them to be true. And there, right there, is where the Spirit of God meets us and changes us. Let's pray.